Let me start by saying that this is October the 27th of October, and I'm at the residence in the farm of Dr. J.T. Watson, Jack Throck Watson, in rural Michigan, and we're going to conduct an oral history of Jack and his career, and I think everything is set and ready to go here. So I'd like to explore, as usual, your early childhood, the influences that led you into science. So tell me a little bit about your parents.
Well, I grew up in small towns in Iowa. In the small town where I went to high school was Nara Springs, Iowa, population of about 1,000. My father was the school superintendent and taught advanced mathematics and physics in said high school. My mother.
What was his name?
Jess H. Watson. He had 10 siblings, 8 of whom settled in Iowa within a radius of 50 miles of our house. So we had many family reunions, so to speak. Virtually every weekend we would get together at one of the uncle's or aunt's house. I grew up with about 10 cousins, some of whom I still hunt and fish with even today. But my father had a very close eye on my performance in math and English. He insisted that I have a 3-point in those courses. So that helped me be prepared for college and eventually graduate school from that early emphasis on math and so forth.
So
my mother was not in science. She was a housewife.
Her name was
Ann Watson.
Was that with A-N-N or E?
A-N-N-E.
E, okay. And her maiden name?
Her maiden name was Young.
Nowadays.
And they
well, go ahead.
She grew up in Springfield, Missouri area. And that's where my parents retired, was to Springfield, Missouri, and they died there.
Nowadays, if you had your parent, if you went to high school today and you had a parent that was in the faculty, it would be an embarrassment for the student, you know, today. Was that the case?
Oh, well, it was tough. I couldn't be a normal kid. I mean, I was the superintendent's kid. So everyone was watching me pretty carefully. It probably was not as bad as being the preacher's son, but being superintendent's son was a little tough. Of course, I had him as an instructor in physics and in algebra. And he had a rule that I couldn't get an A on any exam unless at least one other student did the equivalent, so that I wouldn't And I'm sure he told his faculty to not ease up on me. I mean, I got as many whippings by other faculty members as the normal kids. I guess that's where I was normal.
So when you say whippings, are you talking about physical whippings or?
Physical whippings.
Oh, okay.
Like throwing food in the lunchroom. The shop teacher said, took us down to the shop and said, okay. And there was a big stack of lumber there, and he says, choose your paddle.
Oh, wow. Get away with that today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, my dad was a big believer in corporal punishment.
Oh, okay.
And instilled that in the school. He had a lot of, he made it a point out of hiring male faculty. Hmm. So it was a tough group of guys. Good discipline.
Well, it sounds like it kept you guys in line pretty well.
Indeed.
What about their parents? Did they have any?
In my father's lineage, there were a lot of school teachers.
Okay.
And so he fit into that pattern, I guess. But took an interest somehow in school administration. Got a master's in school administration, which I guess officially helped him get prepared to be the superintendent of schools.
And your mom's background, her parents, were they?
My mother grew up on a farm in western Kansas, and then eventually into Missouri. And that family was in the orchard business, apples, peaches, and fruit, effect, of course.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you have any siblings?
So I have one brother who suffered the same.
Upbringing
as I, with regard to school. he too was to do well in math and English. He became an aeronautical engineer, and I went into chemistry.
Is he older or younger?
He's younger than I.
And his name is?
His name is George. George Houston Watson. Mm-hmm. My father's name was Jess Houston Watson, by the way.
Oh, okay.
So Houston was a common and important name in our family.
Something that was on the tip of my tongue that I lost it. So basically, you really had a fairly strong basic education. The family emphasis was on getting a good education, so there was not an option. You really had to do that.
That's right. Yeah, I was going to go to college.
Okay, that was a given from ground zero.
Right? Yeah.
Now, I noticed one thing that's pretty obvious from just my short brief period here and knowing you previously is that you seem to be very much interested in the outdoors, hunting, natural wildlife, and so on. So that's been a large part of your life. When did that start?
Well, that happened when, effectively, with this large extended family with my father's brothers and sisters living nearby, and of course, all the cousins. We would do a pheasant hunting as a group, and I grew up in northern Iowa, which of course means we're close to Minnesota, and we spent many family trips into Minnesota fishing as a family. So that those bonds were established early on.
So this was at a very young age, I would imagine.
Yeah. I think anywhere from, I suppose, from age of 6, 7 on up through teenager.
Mm-hmm. Now, was your dad, was he involved in this activity of hunting and.
Oh yes.
Okay.
Oh yes. And his brothers and brother-in-law.
So that's really been a major theme in your career, so to speak, being close to nature.
You know, another interesting aspect was that my father and his brother-in-law got into the bluegrass harvest. Bluegrass is the is what grows in most lawns and on golf courses. And in Iowa, bluegrass grows naturally in cow pastures. So it was a common activity during the summer that we would use a fleet of Jeeps, Willys Jeeps, the kind that were used in World War II, and tractors to pull bluegrass strippers through the cow pastures. These were machines that ostensibly or were designed for the purpose of knocking the seeds out of the seed pods in the mature bluegrass without removing the leaves and the stalk of the bluegrass plant, so that we could go into a farmer's pasture, harvest the seed selectively with these bluegrass strippers, strip the seed, so to speak, leaving behind enough of the bluegrass plant so that the farmer could continue to graze the pastures. And that was a fairly good source of income for a school teacher who wasn't making all that much. And for me, it became a source of income that eventually paid for my college education and also help on into graduate school.
So this was strictly a summer job?
That's right. It was summer. Mm-hmm.
And that worked well with your dad since, you know?
As a school teacher, yeah.
Were there any other teachers at your high school that influenced you in any way? I mean, obviously your father had a strong influence, but...
Yes, well, it was very interesting. It was a small high school. The city of Nora Springs had a population of 1,000, and the high school had only a little over 100 students. And there were, in my class, 25 students. And there was pretty good courses given in advanced math, algebra, and trigonometry, so forth. But there was no chemistry in the high school. But the year I was a senior, they made the bold move of establishing a chemistry course. At least that was the idea. The trouble was that they didn't have a chemistry teacher. As it turned out, the English teacher had taken a chemistry course somewhere in his past, which rendered him the candidate for the teaching the course in chemistry. And I told my dad I didn't want to take that course. He said, well, why not? And I said, well, I don't want to be a chemist. I don't want to be running around in a white coat like a Volkswagen mechanic. And he said, well, it's okay if you don't like chemistry, but you need to take the course to figure out whether you do like it. And I figured that was a pretty good argument. And so I took the chemistry course and found it fascinating. Prior to that, because I was pretty good in math, I was sort of headed in the direction of becoming a CPA because I was good with numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness that didn't come to fruition. But it was very clear to me, even before the year's end of the chemistry course, that I wanted to go into chemistry, and so that's in fact what I did. Went to the state school there, Iowa State University, which was renowned for its excellence in science and engineering.
This is a land grant college.
That was a land grant college, yes. Iowa State University at Ames, Iowa. And it's interestingly enough, it was an English teacher that influenced me heavily in to go into chemistry.
So did he?
And my dad said that the reason that he was so that he assigned him to the chemistry course was he was a good salesman. So I guess he sold me. The English teacher sold me on the field of chemistry.
I was just kind of curious if he really was able to convey the material to you in his lectures, or did you have to rely on the book, or obviously he did something to make it interesting.
Well, he certainly went by the book. He had no experience.
No.
Practical experience in chemistry, but he did some experiments. I remember some that made me pretty nervous. the one with sulfuric acid and sodium bicarbonate, mm-hmm. sprayed some sulfuric acid over several members of the class. Thankfully, no one got injured. Some people got holes burned in their clothes, but no injuries, thankfully.
Well, that's a testament to his teaching ability, I guess.
Indeed. Well, my dad said he was a good salesman.
Okay, so you decided, actually, when you entered Iowa State, that chemistry was going to be your major?
Well, in fact, I went to Iowa State undecided as to whether I was going to pursue chemistry or whether I was going to pursue chemical engineering. And as it turned out, there was a program at Iowa State at that time that was effectively a double major, chemistry and chemical engineering, and I took that route. So I've had I took engineering physics and a lot of and of course the chemical engineering hardware course.
Yeah. So you had a pretty broad, this is a 4-year program?
Yes.
So that was pretty intense.
It was. Yeah, I tell you, the second year at Iowa State was a killer. And I was in a fraternity. In fact, eventually became president of the fraternity. And
what's the name of the fraternity?
Theta Xi Fraternity. And I probably need to spell that for you eventually.
Yeah.
That's not too obvious. But as a sophomore, I was taking organic chemistry, engineering, chemical engineering, and differential equations and that sort of thing. But I remember the organic chemistry course lectures were Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. So Friday night, when fraternity brothers were wanting to go out double date, I was getting ready for organic chemistry lecture the following morning. Not a fun time.
No. But you were dedicated to doing what was required to get a good grade in the course.
That's true.
So were there any instructors that were particularly inspiring to you when you were in your college at Iowa State?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I took a special project in my undergraduate days with Harry Sveck, who was a professor of physical chemistry. And I did a special project on determining the charge on an electron using the Millikan oil drop experiment. Sveck was fairly impressed with my result of that special project, and I think he was most influential in directing me toward MIT, and I think it was probably his recommendation that helped me get in there. But the other interesting thing that I learned when I got to Iowa State was that I did not have the usual path into chemistry. Most of my classmates at Iowa State, and these are classes of 100, 200 students, I suppose, most of those students had gotten into chemistry in grade school by using chemistry sets. I had never even seen one. And also most of my classmates were came to Iowa State advanced placed out of high school in chemistry. And of course my English teacher for chemistry didn't offer the advanced placement. No. So I felt a little inadequate. But I managed to survive with hard work.
So besides Sveck, were there any other teachers there that...
No, not particularly. I didn't... I learned early on that organic chemistry was not one of my favorites. Was not a favorite course of mine.
I can't understand why not.
Yeah, Saturday morning classes probably had something to do with it.
I imagine so.
Yeah.
But after your sophomore year, that you were done with organic chemistry.
Yeah, that's true.
Of course, PChem can be a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, PChem was tough.
So you probably followed a pretty intense development of your chemistry knowledge in this period. And you say that Sveck really influenced you with regard to going on to graduate school, or is this something?
Well, yes, he got me. Sveck directed me to apply to graduate school institutions of renown, which I surely wouldn't have done on my own, and in fact, when I got accepted to MIT, I was quite concerned because at that point, I sort of realized that I really didn't know anything in chemistry. And that I needed to study. And so I spent the summer before I went to MIT reviewing all my coursework in chemistry, which helped me, when I got to MIT, helped me qualify qualify in this areas of analytical, physical, and organic, and so forth, the normal process. Mm-hmm. But as I had feared, I found myself among peers who were extraordinarily intelligent, and that both worried me, frightened me to some extent, but in the end became the most rewarding aspect of going to graduate school was the extremely high level of achievement and intelligence of my classmates.
So if Speck hadn't interfered or interceded, you probably, would you have on your own thought about going to graduate school?
I would have, because I realized I didn't know anything. I realized as I was interviewing for industrial jobs, I realized, for example, I didn't know anything about NMR, and I knew that I needed much more study, and my classmates were going to graduate school, so I that was a natural thing to consider.
So it was something that you would have probably pursued without Speck, but he,
I think so. I think in general I would have done that.
And he pointed you in a specific.
I think he suggestively guided me anyway to MIT.
What other schools did you recall? Any other graduate schools?
Well, I applied and was accepted at University of Michigan. Ironically, I joined the faculty eventually at Michigan State University, the arch rival of University of Michigan. But I applied to Penn State, University of Pennsylvania, as I recall. Possibly applied to Berkeley, but I don't remember.
But you opted for MIT.
I did. I think I also did some silly things, like applied to University of Florida because I was tired of walking through slush to class. Silly things like that. So I think that's where Speck stepped in and said, "You need to give this some serious thought."
So eventually you went to another slushy part of the country for graduate work.
Yeah.
It snows in Boston pretty regularly, I'm sure.
Yeah. Not as cold as Iowa.
Yeah.
But there was slush.
Yeah. Sure. So now you go to MIT, and you've got an option of, you got to figure out somebody you want to work for.
Yeah.
So you're, what do you...
Well, again, I didn't very carefully research the faculty. The only thing I knew about mass spectrometry when I was applying to graduate school, and when I went all my way to MIT, the only thing I knew about mass spectrometry was what I learned on that couple of pages in my physics book on electricity and magnetism, where the magnetic sector mass spectrometer is an elegant example of the use of those phenomena. I am embarrassed to say that I didn't know that Klaus Biemann was at MIT before I got there, but upon interviewing the faculty, it was clear that I wanted to work for Klaus Biemann on a project combining a gas chromatograph with a mass spectrometer through an interface that was all glass, so that sensitive molecules like alkaloids and steroids could be analyzed.
Before we go further there, I'd want to just check on one thing, and that was, what did it cost to go to Iowa State? Do you recall?
A few hundred. It was just amazing. I remember just a few hundred dollars for tuition, and I don't know. I lived in Friley Hall, which was renowned as the largest dormitory under one roof on Earth.
How do you spell Friley?
Friley.
Friley?
Yeah.
F-R-I-L-E-Y.
F-R-I-L-E-Y.
And so the expenses for room and board and tuition were...
in the order of hundreds.
Manageable.
Absolutely. I just don't understand why students these days are ostensibly racking up tens of thousands of dollars in loans. I was fortunate in that I had worked in the bluegrass harvest and had earned enough money to pay for my room and board and for my tuition, that and what my parents were willing to contribute. So I did not have to work as during my undergraduate student days.
Okay.
I could focus solely on my studies. I was involved, as I said before, in the administration of social fraternity, Theta Xi, which took a fair amount of time but was a rewarding experience in terms of taking care of a fairly large group of people and the fraternity house, which was a fairly good, big enterprise in itself.
So that was well within reason in terms of expense.
Indeed.
Compared to today's.
Indeed. It's just extraordinary.
Of course, everything was cheaper then, but still.
Gasoline was 25 cents a gallon.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yep, I remember that. All right, so we're back at MIT now. I just wanted to touch on that because it's interesting to keep tabs on what people had to, you know, cost up to the school and studies in that period compared to today. So you wanted to, you met up with Klaus Beeman, he had only been there probably less than a decade by then, I would
That's
think.
That's correct.
But had established a reputation, I believe.
He is an organic chemist by training.
Uh-huh.
And was at MIT first as a postdoc. And then when I got there, he was a professor.
Had he written the book by then?
He had just finished writing his book, Organic Applications of Mass Spectrometry, when I arrived.
And so he posed some possible research problems to you.
Yes, he offered me the possibility of developing methodology to sequence proteins by digesting them into peptides, making volatile derivatives of those peptides to be analyzed by mass spectrometry to learn their sequence, the sequence of overlapping sequences of the peptides would then spell out the sequence of the mother protein. And I told him that I thought that was a little bit too much organic chemistry for me. And I'm sure that offended him. But being the gentleman that he is, he went on to yet another more mechanical project, that of using an effusion device somehow out of perforated or sintered glass to set up conditions of effusion to selectively remove the lightweight helium carrier gas coming from a gas chromatograph from the vaporized analyte, having molecular weight the order of 200 to 300. And that turned out to be a very interesting challenge. He insisted that the device be made of glass. There could be no metal. There could be no micro valves So all the rather easy connections that would be imagined were precluded in his requirement.
And that was why?
Because metal surfaces at 200 or 300 degrees centigrade provides an active surface for decomposition of thermally sensitive labile materials, as were the alkaloids of interest to him, steroids of interest to many people, and so those were the criteria that I had to meet.
And the idea of using the effusion, was his idea?
That was Klaus's idea, was to establish effusion. And he suggested a very clever preliminary experiment to see if this was going to be at all feasible, using pieces of classical glassware available to chemists, those including fritted or sintered glass components that are used in organic syntheses in many cases, or in filtering, mm-hmm. Or in isolating certain chemicals in classical wet chemistry laboratory experiments. And once we proved the efficacy of using in establishing the conditions of effusion, which was molecular flow, and that is to say the conditions for that are well described in physics as being the discriminating interface had pores in the sintered glass, the diameter of which was about 1/10 the mean free path of the gaseous mixture. And that would allow, in principle, for good separation based on inverse square root relationship of mass to affect the discrimination, mm-hmm. by preferentially there by pulling off or pulling away the helium, leaving behind the enriched analyte vapor to go into the mass spectrometer, which had a fairly limited value on the pressure that could be tolerated in the ion source. And vacuum pumps at that stage were hard pressed to keep up with the leaks in the gaskets to the flanges of the mass spectrometer. There was no way they could accommodate the flow coming out of a packed column. And so it was necessary to reduce the flow that would eventually go into the mass spectrometer. So that was the challenge.
So I know that Klaus had a time of flight instrument in his laboratory at one time that he used kind of like for proof of principle experiments.
So I did my prototype studies were carried out on the Bendix time of flight mass spectrometer, taking pictures of the mass spectra on an oscilloscope with a Polaroid film.
So you use these like substitute pieces of glass with effusive properties in time of flight to experiment with.
So finally, yes. So we've some Rube Goldberg experiments showed that, in fact, there was useful discrimination against the low molecular weight or low mass carrier gas could be achieved by establishing the conditions of effusion where the pore size was the order of microns. I don't remember the exact dimensions, but the order of microns.
And then eventually came up with this concept where there was a tube of effusive glass.
Yeah.
That was...
Yeah, so you know, once we established the efficacy of the idea, then I designed a more flow-friendly design where, with great difficulty and bribes of a bottle or two of Jack Daniels, we got the glass blower to construct from fritted glass bubbling tubes that are used to degas solutions in organic chemistry or in any solutions, to physically drill hole to make this pod of fritted glass into a tube, a fritted glass tube that would be part of a continuum of capillary going into the fritted glass tube, and then the fritted glass tube had to be glass blown to yet another capillary to make the final reduction in pressure going into the mass spectrometer. So this was a nightmare for the glass blower, and I spent a lot of time cajoling him and finding out that Jack Daniels was one of his favorite beverages. Because under glass blowing conditions, the porous glass effectively exploded because the glass pores, of course, were filled with air, and when that got heated, they just exploded. Mm. But miraculously, he was able to complete assembly, and I think we never got a second one. And I remember I had a troop of my sibling graduate students, where I go down the hall to the glass blower carrying this delicate piece of glass. I would have them run interference for me at various intersections in the hallway. I couldn't afford to bump into someone coming around a blind corner and smashing this precious piece of glass. That was pretty good. Yeah. Oh, mercy.
So you had to actually take a piece of fritted glass that was designed for a completely different purpose, yeah, and drill a hole through it.
Yeah.
And then have the glass blower. And
then use that as a tube.
Yeah.
To
put together into the
to fuse to the end of that.
Yeah.
Capillary.
Yeah.
Which could be collapsed to a small orifice to establish the pressure drop.
Yeah.
Necessary to achieve conditions of molecular flow in the fritted tube.
Yeah. So that he was a pretty good glass blower.
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't all that patient, but I spent a lot of time. We became friends. But but you know, buying a fifth of Jack Daniels off the graduate student's salary was was a handicap.
An investment.
That was a big investment.
Yeah.
But thank goodness he was able to make at least one work.
Yeah.
I think we never got a second one.
All right, but then once that proof of principle had been demonstrated, I think you could actually buy these tubes, fritted glass tubes from Dow Corning, or I know you could buy the assemblies of a separator, a fusion separator.
Where could you buy them?
I don't remember, but I know we bought some because then we did some experiments comparing the different types of microseparator devices.
I see.
And I guess we bought it from Dow Corning. I don't know, but I mean,
I'll be darned.
I think there's one. Might even have one at home. One of those deals.
Yeah.
Or we gave it to the I don't know.
I think there was something. There apparently these were available on the RMU or something, Varian or something, or I can't remember.
Could be, yeah.
I can't remember.
Well, the instrument manufacturers picked up on
Sparkman. Yeah, Sparkman would remember these things.
Yeah. So that was basically your thesis topic.
That was the dissertation. Mm-hmm. Topic was based on. And we eventually used this separator after being optimized on the time of flight mass spectrometer. We adapted it to fit on the ion source of a double focusing magnetic sector mass spectrometer, where we used photoplate to detect the signal, which had the advantage of sort of a ray detection, but also an integrating effect of the ion current that, of course, fluctuated in unison with the partial pressure of the analyte as it emerged from the gas chromatograph.
Mm-hmm. So, at this particular point in Beeman's career, he had probably a pretty decent stable of students.
Yes. Yeah.
And who were your graduate siblings at the time? Do you recall?
Well, my siblings included Dominic Desiderio and Paul Voros, John Hayes, and just as I was leaving, Ron Heitz joined the group.
What about Al Burlingame? Is he a previous?
Al Burlingame was leaving about the time I was finishing my experimental work.
Ah, okay.
And Jim McCloskey.
Oh, Jim.
Was in residence for most of my time at MIT.
Uh-huh.
And was a valuable consultant to me on many things.
During graduate
life, and
well, that's a very interesting group of people for sure.
Oh, it was wonderful. Then I had friends from other parts of chemistry, notably John Deutsch, who was in theoretical chemistry or quantum mechanics, and he and eventually we were roommates.
Mm-hmm.
on Commonwealth Avenue in Boston and would have many good visits as we commuted across Harvard Bridge from Boston over to MIT, spending nights at the library waiting for the bus to take us back across Harvard Bridge at night. And of course, John Deutsch not only was interesting, but of note, he became eventually the director of the CIA in recent years. He had gained notoriety in Washington, D.C. from early stages of our careers in graduate school together. Early, he was chosen as one of Robert McNamara's whiz kids in the Defense Department. And so I think it's through those connections that John was tapped to be director of the CIA.
How did he get noticed by McNamara?
I don't know. I think Deutsch's father was an ambassador, somehow involved in government. So John became well networked into the Washington hierarchy and society, so to speak, at an early age. And that eventually turned into summer jobs. I guess the Whiz Kids group was more than a summer job. Mm-hmm. But he retained that.
But you say he was studying theoretical chemistry.
Yes, he was in... quantum mechanics. What do you want to call that?
Theoretical chemistry.
Yeah, I mean, and in deference to John, I took a course in quantum mechanics. Yeah. With lectures from Paul Slater. And I was totally lost. Uh-huh. I never could catch on to the philosophy. But interestingly enough, I was sitting in a lecture on quantum mechanics by Paul Slater the afternoon that John F. Kennedy was shot. And Paul Slater walked in and announced that the president is dead. Wow.
Yeah.
So we were stunned, of course.
Yeah.
Still am.
Yeah.
But I mean, those guys just think in integrals and differential. I just couldn't. I mean, I just did shit from apple butter about what we were going to. I talked to John about it a little bit, but I didn't want to talk too much because I'm sure it just embarrassed the hell out of him. How could he be talking to a turkey like me? Oh, man.
So you had a fairly normal graduate experience, what, about four or five years in the Beeman lab?
I think I was there exactly 5 years.
Okay.
Because it turned out that I had a commitment to go on active duty in the Air Force. So I think I was on, I had a delay from active duty to go to graduate school.
Uh-huh.
And I had to finish the graduate school at a certain time. I think that's what helped establish the short tenure, so to speak.
Wow. Well, then we have to find out a little bit about your commitment. How did that come about?
I went through the advanced ROTC program at Iowa State University.
Okay.
At the end of which, I was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the USAF. And then I got a delay from active duty to go to graduate school. And the delay from active duty had time limits. I had to finish the degree within a certain period of time.
Okay. So there was a certain amount of let's get it done and get out of here.
Yeah.
Kind of. Yes.
Yeah.
And your decision to go into the military was for any particular reason, or?
Well, yes, I felt an obligation. I had cousins that ran across Normandy Beach in 1944. I felt if they had to do that, I had to do something. So I wasn't drafted. But I had to go into ROTC. It was part of the program at Iowa State. Mm-hmm. Everyone had to go into ROTC.
For the first 2 years.
For the first 2 years. But I just decided to apply for and was accepted into the advanced program. Mm-hmm. And was being cultivated because I didn't wear glasses. Most of my classmates who were in the advanced program at Iowa State wore glasses, and they were, of course, did not qualify for flight training, and so I was. That was a path that they were hoping I would follow, and I did, and enjoyed. I actually enjoyed summer camp very much, and after exciting rides in jet aircraft, including an F-100 and a refueling mission of a B-52, I was pretty excited about flying. Mm-hmm. And I almost committed myself, but I was under the impression that it was going to be a 3-year commitment. But as it got down to the wire, they said, that's going to be 5 years. So that realization, plus the realization that I was not a likely candidate to be a top gun. Mm-hmm. I didn't figure I was that gung ho on a daily basis. I was afraid that I'd probably push the wrong button someday in the cockpit and either go flying out through the canopy or somehow they'd be washing me off the runway with a hose. So I declined going into pilot training.
Okay, but you did stay.
But I stayed. I did stay for the 3-year commitment, and I was eventually. Well, as it turns out, the Moffett Field in Palo Alto, California, had a famous scientist who was studying chemical evolution, Cyril Ponnampurumah, arranged for me to go work at Moffett Field as a civilian, pending my orders to report for active duty. So, in fact, I worked at Moffett Field in the Ames Research Center with Cyril Panempuruma on chemical evolution, which simulated primitive conditions on Earth in ancient times, where they were using electrical discharges in flasks containing nitrogen gas, water vapor.
And you know how to spell Panam?
I'll have to do that separately. That's a big deal. It's a long word. It'll be on my. I don't know if it's on my CV. It's probably not. But it's P O, then Nam.
Yeah, Aruma. Yeah.
Aruma.
Yeah, I can find it.
He was at University of. He went to the University of Maryland.
So why? I mean, when this guy was, was he in the Air Force?
No. No. So it turns out he was Ames Research Center. Turned out to be at Moffett Field,
okay,
which was a Navy base.
Okay.
And I was in the Air Force.
Yeah.
And they were trying. Panempuruma was trying to get me cleared to serve my military tour in his laboratory at Ames Research Center.
All right, here's the second lieutenant with a PhD in analytical chemistry.
Yes.
Says, oh, these guys don't come along too often.
Oh, yeah, so it finally came down to a discussion, so to speak, between a general in the Air Force and an admiral in the Navy. And the general said, we need Watson at the USAF School of Aerospace Medicine, where we were simulating conditions in the manned orbiting laboratory in a closed environment. Mm-hmm. And they had a mass spectrometer, but they didn't have anyone that understood how to use it.
Okay.
Turned out to be a time of flight, by the way.
And the admiral said,
no deal.
Uh-huh.
He's or the ad. Well, it was the admiral wanted me.
Ah.
Because okay. Because that was the Navy base.
Yeah, right.
And that's where I don't really understand the complexity, but Ames Research Center, I guess, was part of the Navy base. So the Navy was going to have to get the Air Force to let me go, and that didn't work out.
So you never got to work with Panempuruma?
I did for a month.
Ah, okay.
And we did some standard experiments of identifying from the brown gunk that formed in these spark chambers. I actually isolated amino acids.
Oh, really?
And it was amazing what they found in this gunk, where these had high voltage arcs simulating lightning.
Yeah.
In this primitive atmosphere
of
nitrogen. No oxygen.
No oxygen.
I guess maybe it was a limited amount of oxygen.
Yeah.
I think the early atmosphere apparently was mostly reducing.
Yeah. But so you only got to work for a month because the Air Force says you're going with us.
You got to report to San Antonio, Texas.
Okay. So now here you are, a second lieutenant, PhD, analytical chemist.
It's School of Aerospace Medicine.
Okay.
And they were, among other things, studying the stress of confinement on these pilots that had been talked into going into this altitude chamber. So that's where I got my interest in steroids and in biomedical applications of mass spectrometry, which we didn't do much of there, but I saw the
potential.
For that interaction, and that helped me establish the focus of research in my early career, in the early phases of my research career, and which eventually directed me to the Division of Clinical Pharmacology at Vanderbilt University, where I worked with prostaglandins.
So what did you do besides this experiment at the aerospace medicine? You were there for what? Were there all 3 years, the whole time you were there?
At
San Antonio?
Yes. Yes, so...
And this was about the time Vietnam was heating up, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
They didn't, nobody came around saying, hey, dude, you know...
Yeah, well, that was always a possibility. I mean, I was not looked at... from a distance as a mass spec guy. I was looked at from a distance as a chemist. Uh-huh. And they could just as well have said, we need a chemist to check the pH in these deltas.
Uh-huh.
You know, that was always a possibility. But I never saw action in the Vietnam combat.
There was never any effort to move you away from this job in aerospace medicine into a more military role?
No.
That was kind of, I mean, that lucked out for you because I think Vietnam left a bad mark on a lot of people.
Yes.
That went there.
Yes. Indeed. Yes. And I felt like I should go. I mean, you know, there were guys dying over there. Why should I be sitting around my Boy Scout camp over there at Brooks Air Force Base? But that's what I did.
Yeah.
Because that's what my boss told me to do.
Yeah, well, that's...
And I was shielded in a way.
Yeah. So was there any mass spec involved in that Brooks Air Force Base
activity? Oh, yes. Yes, a principal concern for the manned orbiting laboratory were what kind of materials would accumulate in the atmosphere of the closed environment. And so that was our mission. As it turned out, they were pretty good scrubbers to pull things out of the closed atmospheres, and so there never seemed to be any threat of poisoning due to any organics building up other than what was coming out of the fabrics. Mm-hmm. of the materials in the... There was not, so it as it turned out, mass spectrometry, we didn't do anything significant. In fact, what I did was help develop methodology to determine plasma levels of testosterone, because there was concern from it. About the impact of confinement on endocrinology. Mm-hmm. And so we were gearing up, and in fact I developed methodology based on mainly gas chromatography, but as backed up by GCMS. Mm-hmm. for plasma testosterone. Mm-hmm. Because one of the there were many, many of my colleagues at School of Aerospace Medicine were new MDs who had been drafted effectively to serve a tour of duty at the School of Aerospace Medicine to participate in these experiments where individuals would go into altitude chambers for weeks, if not months, at a time. Mm-hmm. In an environment of
simulated
30% oxygen as diluted by helium at a total pressure of a third of an atmosphere, which turns out to be the pressure at 10,000 feet. But more importantly, that was the pressure that could be held or confined pressure that could be held in a spacecraft that was there was a limitation. I mean, the Russians had powerful enough rockets that they could blast off spacecraft that could withstand one atmosphere of pressure differential. Mm-hmm. And they had short sleeve environment, 80% nitrogen, 20% oxygen. The U.S. had to have a lighter payload, which meant that the spacecraft was not as strong as the Russians, which meant that the total pressure differential could be no more than a third of an atmosphere.
That was the environment that they had to establish.
Yeah.
For these guinea pigs.
Yeah.
Now, I understand one time they thought of using, instead of a mixture of oxygen and helium, they were thought of using pure oxygen.
Yes. In fact, that was the protocol for the beginning of the space program. Apparently, all of the space shots, perhaps even including John Glenn, was that he was in 100% oxygen.
At a reduced pressure, but still 100% oxygen.
Yeah. And this was all because of payload. They couldn't. Yeah. Well, they had to have 100% oxygen so that you get enough on each breath, mm-hmm. and it. At 30% oxygen in helium at one third of an atmosphere. There was enough oxygen pulled into the lung per breath that led to a partial pressure of oxygen in the bloodstream that is the same as that achieved in the normal atmosphere of only 20% oxygen because it was enriched.
Mm-hmm. But using 100% oxygen, even at reduced pressure, was dangerous.
It was certainly dangerous. It was an unbelievable fire hazard. And some colleagues died in a fire in our building due to an electrical spark that ignited clothing in 100% oxygen. And it was about that time, within weeks or months, that three astronauts burned to death in the space capsule on top of the rocket when there was a fire in the spacecraft in 100% oxygen. So it's a very dangerous situation.
And when did they give up using?
I'm sure that's true.
Yeah, well, it's too dangerous.
Yeah.
So you had 3 years of kind of, what would you call it, human endurance research in the Air Force, looking at and then looking also at whatever compounds might accumulate.
Sort of a environmental control.
Yeah.
And looking at and assisting with stress on the endocrine system due to confinement and any aberrations in atmospheric conditions. You know, it wasn't expected that helium would have any effect, but it was necessary to have the experiment to prove that there had no effect, and it did not.
Yeah. Very good. Now, you're ending your three-year hitch is coming up to an end, so you're having to think about your future from here. You're done with the Air Force, you've satisfied your obligation. Where do you go from there?
Yeah, so I continue to realize my deficiency in organic chemistry. And so I had met through James McCloskey, who was then at the Institute for Lipid Research, at Baylor Medical School. That he had a visiting scientist from France in his lab, whose name was Robert Wolff.
Very French sounding.
And Robert Wolff was a organic synthetic chemist. Organic synthesis chemist, I guess I should say. And he, Robert Wolff, was interested in my coming to his lab as a postdoc to help his efforts to develop GCMS on a French mass spectrometer. And he would also provide, for my benefit, a research project that would involve my learning organic synthesis techniques to install deuterium atoms at specific sites in long chain organic acids. So this was an opportunity for me to learn practical organic mass spectrometry on the job, so to speak.
In organic synthesis.
In organic synthesis.
Yeah.
And that led to it's a very interesting project. And it provided me with organic chemistry skills in practical sense that became quite useful to my early career research at Michigan State in the laboratory, manufacturing, among other things, diazomethane, a dangerous but convenient means for producing methyl esters of fatty acids, which was of interest to me.
In this connection with McCloskey was just from proximity.
Yes.
He was at Waco, basically Baylor's in Waco. You were in San
really?
Antonio.
I thought I was in Houston.
Well, he might have been in Houston. I guess Baylor had a medical license.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. He was in Houston. You were in San Antonio.
Yeah.
I
don't know where. I don't even know where the hell Waco is. I heard of it.
Waco,
is it in West Tennessee? West Texas?
No, Waco is if you go north of Austin. If you draw a line between San Antonio and Austin and keep going north, you'll run into Waco.
Oh, I see. So
it's on Highway 35.
Oh, okay. I see.
So, yeah, he was at the medical center, Baylor.
Yeah, he was at the Institute.
He was at the Horning?
Yeah, correct.
Horning?
Yes, Evan Horning.
Okay, but you kind of had kept up with him?
Oh, but I kept up with McCloskey.
Oh, okay.
McCloskey and I were close at MIT, and then I kept up with Jim as he was at Baylor.
Okay.
And
so this is how you made the connection with this French...
Yeah, and so that became a postdoc for me, which turned out to be very useful. And very enjoyable.
Yeah, so
at the,
it was
at Strasbourg.
Oh, okay.
Institute de Chemistry, Institute de Chimie, Université de Strasbourg.
So, how's your French? I mean, you're going to France. Can you speak French?
Un peu. Je peux parler quelques mots. Mais c'est pas grand chose.
Okay.
C'est une pas grand chose. Hey. Je peux commander le viande, le vin dans le restaurant.
All right. Well, I don't speak French, so we're in trouble. But it was an experience, I'm sure.
Oh, it was wonderful. Oh, Strasbourg is such a wonderful little village, little town, little city. Oh, it's a wonderful place to have lunch. Wonderful place to have lunch. Yeah.
So
I spent a year there.
Besides having lunch, what did you do scientifically when you were there? You're learning some organic chemistry.
Well, interestingly enough, Robert Wolf had the idea. Somehow he had found out that making a dicyano derivative of imagine a carbonyl in a carboxylic acid group, and it somehow he read somewhere that a dicyano derivative had the same electronic structure somehow as a methyl ester of same carboxylic acid. So he thought it might behave similarly under fragmentation conditions, EI, but it didn't. It formed an unbelievable picket fence of peaks, which I told Mike Gross was a perfect example of remote site cleavage. Mm-hmm. I showed him that at a site visit once, when he was site visiting me. And I don't know. Yeah, I don't think he was impressed. But in order to try to figure out the fragmentation pattern or the fragmentation mechanism, I synthesized these deuterium-labeled analogs of the carboxylic acid, and then made the dicyano derivative thereof.
Uh-huh.
And so, and that was Robert Wolff's interest, and it was an interesting thing. But I learned all these techniques in the process of making these analogs.
Uh-huh.
That's pretty neat to make an analog where there's two deuterium atoms on the alpha carbon,
mm-hmm.
and another one where there's hydrogens on the alpha carbon and deuterium's on the beta carbon. And so that was, I learned a hell of a lot.
Well, you had a year there, right?
Yeah.
To learn all that good stuff.
Yeah, but I was not the best set of hands you ever had in your lab. Any more or less, let me know that.
Uh-huh.
It was not a very tactful person.
But it was good for you to get that experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Served me very well.
So what else? Was there anything interesting going on in France while you were there that kind of gives us a sense of the time? This was, what, in the late 60s?
Well, that's when the band are landing on the moon.
Oh, yeah.
What's his name? Glenn Adford? What's his name?
Yeah.
What is... one giant step for mankind, and or something, or whatever Samuel that was, that happened then.
I guess that was covered pretty intensely in the French.
Yes, oh yes.
The Americans were good guys then, huh?
Yes.
They were still good guys.
Yeah. And they were pleased to see the success of the launch and the landing. Wow. It was a big deal. I felt like a hot shit. Like, I'm an American.
Yeah.
And I remember other postdocs. One guy from Britain was really disdainful of our involvement in Vietnam. And,
oh, yeah.
And I always say, well, shit. We've got treaties. Well, if we had a treaty with Great Britain and you guys got attacked by Germany, would you want us to come to your rescue?
Yeah.
You know, so we did have that con game.
Yeah.
In South Vietnam. We had, it turned out they were frauds, I guess. I never did figure out what happened. Did you?
Well, I think what happened was the mentality of the time was that it was a domino effect. You know, if you let Vietnam go to the communists, South Vietnam go to the communists, then this would go communist, and that would go communist, and then the communists would end up taking over that part of the world.
Yeah.
We'd all be in deep doo-doo.
Yeah.
Great fear of the communists, so there's no question about that. And I think that's probably what drove it more than anything, was this fear. This fear.
Yeah, okay. Oh, I still have this thing on. I'm just going to sit. I'm going to sit in my chair.
Okay.
I need a little rest.
All right, I
don't have very good stamina. All right, yeah.
Well, let me grab this here, and then we can take a break.
Yeah.
Okay.
Put this over this?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. Oh, you know, were you asking me what I turned on my lathe?
Oh, yeah.
Here's some examples. This is pretty handy, don't you think?
Looks like a serious weapon.
That's a mallet. We were just told to do that in the class one day.
Uh-huh.
I found something else over here last night I think you asked me what I made. Did you?
Yeah.
Well, I'll show you one thing, which is fun.